The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week, we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Petra Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Philip Womack shares his own experience of conflicts over university reading lists and asks, is it really too much to ask students to read a book? Ian Thompson reads his letter from Albania and contemplates how much the Balkan nation has changed since the dictatorship of Enver Hoxha. The director of Big Brother Watch, Silky Carlo, reveals the surprising rise of supermarket surveillance. Discussing a tradition that appears to have waned, Francis Young provides his notes on Halloween fairies. And finally, Rory Sutherland worries that Britain may soon face a different sort of migrant crisis. Up first, Philip Womack.
The Shakespeare scholar Sir Jonathan Bate recently claimed that students are struggling to read long books. Depressingly, he's right. I could have told him the same thing 5 years ago when I was teaching at a well-respected Russell Group university. The problem isn't that students won't read Moby Dick in 5 days. It's that even if you give them what they want, they'll still find fault. This all points to a tussle at the heart of modern education. Do you cave in to the blighters or not? To my surprise, when convening a BA course on children's literature, I discovered that some of my students balked at reading children's books. The course looked at the whole caboodle, from the Romantics to the present day. It wasn't a DOS. The reading included knotty stuff like Rousseau, as well as all the primary texts. Most students seemed to enjoy it. Why wouldn't they? Aslan and Bilbo Baggins. It was also intellectually stimulating, with literary, politico-ideological and biographical elements to absorb. One day, after giving a lecture on J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, I waited for questions. Several hands shot up. Do we have to read all the books? Came the first inquiry. Yes, I laughed. All 7, was the plaintive response. I answered firmly that it was Potter week. They'd had the reading list since June. And if they wanted to write their final essays on Potter, they'd have to refer to all 7. We'd been discussing the series as a bildungsroman. Later, an email pinged in. There had been complaints. 4, to be precise, from students who thought I had unfairly dismissed their concerns. I was yanked in for a meeting with a couple of departmental bigwigs. I defended myself. I had devoted months to preparing this course. Surely it was not beyond the capabilities of the average student to read the Harry Potter books, especially when most would already be au fait with Hogwarts. I mentioned that when the 7th and final book was published at 607 pages, critics read it overnight. Above all, not to read the set texts was a discourtesy. Who could argue with any of that, I wondered afterwards. Well, I was wrong. The students were given a free pass and Yarboo sucks to my lectures. Buildings what? Even after that, many students' final essays only referred to the films, as if I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It was all quite deflating. Many educators nowadays suggest a balance between what students want and what academics want to give them. There is a Goldilocks zone where lecturer and student meet. This is fine, up to a point. There is also the question of relatability. Why should the modern youth pore over weird sailors chasing whales when they can delight in Cat Person by Kristin Rupinian? It shouldn't need to be stated that feeling uncomfortable is an element of the pursuit of knowledge. There are utilitarian benefits also. Gaining the ability to grind through something apparently tedious sets you in excellent stead for life. I'm not sure about the debilitating effects of TikTok et al. On concentration spans, but what I am sure about is that if you surrender to the students who complain, they'll only make more demands. 7 books of Harry Potter too much? How about 3? 1? A page? a summary? In the end, if students complain when things don't go their way, they are not entirely to blame. They don't yet know what they want. It's mainly the fault of decades of educational theory and of a university culture that's forgotten what it's supposed to do. The educational establishment must address the fact that learning things properly is not always a teddy bear's picnic, and it needs to acknowledge that always caving in to students' whims isn't right. Reading that doesn't immediately spark joy is the best kind, because at some point it might spark something else, and the world will light up in ways you'd never imagined. As a whole culture, we need to remember to stand firm. If students are required to read what's on the list, even if they find it a chore, they'll appreciate it. Many people, years after graduation, regret not taking full advantage of the learning on offer. I've never heard anyone say, "I'm glad they didn't stretch me."
That was Philip Womack. Now, Ian Thompson.
Albanians are descended from the most ancient of European peoples, the Illyrians. The country came into existence only after 1912, with the demise of Ottoman power in Europe. Its first ruler, the glorified Muslim chieftain King Zog, was hounded out by Mussolini when fascist Italy invaded in 1939. Zog was put up in London for a while at the Ritz. 5 years later, the Nazi Germans were expelled by the Albanian resistance fighter Enver Hoxha. Outwardly a Stalinist, the artful Hoxha was a Muslim-born Ottoman dandy figure who terrorised his Balkan fiefdom through retaliatory murders, purges, and the trapdoor disappearance of class enemies. Albania has long lived in Italy's shadow. Last week, the Italian Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, was reportedly furious when her plan to send asylum seekers to Albania was blocked by the European Court of Justice, and the immigrants were sent back to Italy from an offshore detention facility. She is unlikely to give up. I first visited the troubled Balkan outpost in 1988, when Hoxha's anointed successor, Ramiz Alia, was in charge. The dictator's widow, Nejmia Hoxha, the Lady Macbeth of the Balkans, was the hidden hand behind the feared Sigurimi secret police. As individual tourists were not allowed in, I went in a group of 20 friends of the Royal Scottish Academy. Among them was Lady Rosebery. "A countess," gasped our Albanian guide. At a customs shed on the Yugoslav border, one of our party had his beard shaved off, as beards were synonymous with Greek orthodoxy and banned. I returned to Albania recently with my wife on a hiking holiday through the accursed mountains that border onto Kosovo and Montenegro. The night before we left, at the Café Otto in London, we saw the composer Dave Smith perform his Albanian Summer Fantasia with Jan Steele on saxophone and his wife Janet Sherborne on piano. The music, hypnotically good, was inflected with the Ottoman folk rhythms that Smith had gathered on visits to the Albanian highlands during Hoxha's 40-year regime. Our idea was to follow in the footsteps of the Edwardian ethnographer Edith Durham, who in the early 1900s tramped across the highlands in a waterproof Burberry skirt and plaid golf cap, recording tribal customs. The Albanians were so taken with her and her book High Albania that they crowned her Queen of the Mountain People. From our hotel on Edith Durham Street in the northern Albanian city of Shkodër, we set out for Bajram Suri, some 30 miles west of the Serbian border. The countryside was a wild jumble of chestnut forests and moorland tarns. We climbed on up through alpine meadowlands towards Valbona, with the irregular fangs of Mount Shkeltsen hazy in the distance. The uplands were busy with excursionists, Albania is the fastest growing tourist destination in Europe. In the mountain hamlet of Theth, we came across a partially ruined refuge tower, or kulla. Hardly any of these towers survive in Albania. In pre-communist times, they served as sanctuary for Albanians caught up in blood feuds. The Ottoman-era revenge cult of Jack per Jack, blood for blood, is sanctioned by Albania's ancient tribal constitution known as the Kanun, which the Illyrians codified. Enver Hoxha made a great show of outlawing the Kanun as backward Balkan tribalism, but it resurfaced briefly after communism collapsed. On a visit to Theth 30 years ago, I met an old woman who had been betrothed by her father in utero, in accordance with the Kanun. "And now look who I'm stuck with," she gestured to a sleazy-looking pasha lying in a bed with a white skull cap. "Ah, shut up, my dear old thing," he countered. The great engine of vengeance, the old idea of purification by blood, was the subject of the late Albanian writer Ismail Kadare's novel Broken April. Blood will always be quick on the knife in Albania, and in East London too. The Albanian gangs who have captured the cocaine market in the UK abide by the Kanun Code of Beja, the necessity of keeping a promise. Jack per Jack ensures gang loyalty. Albania's capital, Tirana, is a buzzy place today with a surfeit of bars. Opposite the Hoxha's huge empty villa is a KFC takeaway. Hoxha's children threatened legal action when plans were announced to turn the villa into a museum of oppression. Endre and Nejmir are believed to have owned 25 refrigerators, 28 colour television sets, and 19 telephone lines. Enver was known for his love of Norman Wisdom films, which cock a snook at factory owners. Not one of his sigurimi was ever put on trial for torture or other cruelties. Nejmir died in 2020 at the age of 99. I interviewed her when she was under house arrest on corruption charges in Party Villa No. 6 off Tirana's Boulevard of National Martyrs. Enver's bronze statue had just been toppled. "That was more painful to me than his actual death," she said. Nejmir and her husband executed more than 6,000 Albanian political opponents, jailed around 34,000, 1,000 of whom died, and sent 59,000 into internal exile. Albania under the Hoxhas was a self-immolated model of Stalinist planning. On our last night in Tirana, we dined out on Lake Shkodra carp fish, milk curds and maize bread. The waiter had a beard.
That was Ian Thompson. Next, Silky Carlo.
Britain's obsession with surveillance is reaching new heights. Several of the UK's largest retailers have quietly installed facial recognition checkpoints on their doorways and inside their shops. It means that automated identity checks are taking place on our high streets without customers even being aware of it. The cameras look like any other CCTV cameras, except they take a biometric scan of every customer's face, like at a passport e-gate. The facial recognition scans are then compared against a private database run by the software company Facewatch. The database is populated by various shop CCTV images of people that security staff think may be involved in crime or disorder. You won't be informed if your photo is taken and added to a watch list. Neither is a police report required for your face to be added. The system operates entirely separately to law enforcement. Many retailers have started to use Facewatch, including Budgens, Morrisons, Sports Direct, Flannels, and Home Bargains. As shoplifting rates rise, more companies are installing Facewatch software. According to the British Retail Consortium, only 8% of incidents of violence and abuse are prosecuted. And since shops are giving up on the police, they aren't the only ones,
It is estimated that only a third of such incidents are even reported. While I understand that security staff have a difficult job to do, it would be plainly dangerous to let them replace the police, judges, and juries, yet that is effectively what has happened. Members of the public are being technologically blacklisted from major retailers on the say of security guards, often without knowing what they've been accused of or how to clear their name. The truth is, they can't. The story of one woman, who I'll call Anna, gives a chilling insight into how FaceWatch's surveillance system works. Anna is a quiet woman in her 60s with physical health problems. She was taken to the shops by her adult children several months ago when she was picked out and stopped by staff who told her to leave. When she asked why, security refused to tell her, but said she'd been flagged by their facial recognition cameras and the system said she was banned. The family was escorted out and shown a tiny sticker on the store's entrance, obscured by racks of garden plants, indicating that FaceWatch's facial recognition was in operation. With the support of her children, Anna contacted FaceWatch to ask why she had been blacklisted. For her request to even be processed, she had to send a legal subject access request to the company with copies of her photo ID. Given that the company had already covertly taken and misused photos of her, this seems like an absurd and insulting demand, yet it was a legal requirement to find out what data they held on her. It turned out that a security guard has suspected her of taking goods from a store worth £1, a mere £1, some weeks earlier, and had then added her photo to the database. When asked if the company had any video evidence of the alleged incident, the answer was no. Anna says that's because it never happened. It certainly would be out of character for a lady in her 60s to launch a criminal career by taking an item worth so little from a shop where she regularly spends considerable amounts. Nevertheless, FaceWatch insists she is a legitimate target of their high-tech system and that she will remain blacklisted from this retailer and other shops in the area that use its surveillance system. Anna doesn't know where she can and can't go without risking the public humiliation of being flagged by facial recognition cameras and accused of being a thief. She's stuck in limbo, treated like a criminal with no ability to prove her innocence. As well as the risks of relying on security guards' hunches to build a high-tech privatised policing system, the technology itself is also not free from error. Sarah is a teenager who was flagged by a facial recognition camera in a home bargain store she had never visited before. She was accosted by staff who proceeded to search her bag before throwing her out of the store. They told her she was banned from shops and supermarkets using the surveillance system. After Sarah went through the same laborious complaint process as Anna, it transpired that, on this occasion, FaceWatch was willing to admit that there was a system fault. Sarah simply looked like someone else on the database. One of the problems of relying on security guards' intuition is that they risk falling prey to prejudice and stereotypes. Both Anna and Sarah are women of colour. It's perhaps less likely that a middle-class white woman would be added to a blacklist for an unevidenced £1 theft allegation. FaceWatch collects photos of what it calls subjects of interest using local intelligence. This type of language reflects a deeper transformation taking place in society. Shop staff are now frontline workers, armed with body-worn cameras. I remember when checkout staff were people you had a chat with and who offered to pack your shopping for you. Now we check out our shopping under the watch of a camera and a screen broadcasting potential transgressions to other customers. Suspicion is creeping into everyday life and is being normalised to help protect corporate profits. Live facial recognition in shops is considered unlawful across most of the democratic world. A Spanish supermarket was fined €2.5 million by its data watchdog for using it. The UK has the same data laws as the EU, in the form of the GDPR, But the UK Information Commissioner has let surveillance tech spread, under pressure from ministers in the last government to act in Facewatch's favour. What faith can we have in the regulators anyway? The last biometrics commissioner left his post to become a director at Facewatch.
That was Silky Carlo. Now, Francis Young.
Among the many options available for Halloween costumes and decorations these days, from witches to zombies, from mummies to serial killers, there is one traditional Halloween character you are unlikely to see: fairies. But in Irish and Scottish folklore, which provides the basis for modern Halloween traditions, fairies were central to this festival. In Scotland, it was on Halloween night that the fairy raid, or procession, was said to be seen going through the countryside, bearing the souls of the unbaptized dead, or those who were snatched away in life by the fairies. In the Ballad of Tam Lin, Janet has to wait until the fairies ride at Halloween to rescue her otherworldly lover from the clutches of the fairy queen. In Ireland, it was at Samhain, Halloween, that the fairies emerged from the ancient burial mounds, the Shí, in which they dwelt, and heroes such as Finn McCool did battle with them by throwing his spear into the mounds as they opened. So why do we seem to have forgotten the association between Halloween and the fairies? One reason is that the Halloween now celebrated in England with trick-or-treating, pumpkins and ghoulish costumes is primarily a transatlantic borrowing from America. The intimate association between fairies and the land meant that they did not always travel well, despite the deep Irish influence on American folk culture. Another reason is that the fairies themselves have undergone a transformation in folklore. Most people today think of small and benevolent winged beings, not of the terrifying fairy queen who declares her wish to tear out Tamlin's heart and replace it with a heart of stone. The fact that fairies were once part of our celebration of Halloween might tell us something about the origins of this festival. Some folklorists have speculated that the association between fairies and ancient burial mounds, and the fact that they emerge at Halloween, reveals that the fairies are, in fact, the deified ancestral dead. They are the exalted prehistoric ancestors whose bones were carefully defleshed and arranged on shelves in long barrows and moved about for centuries in acts of ritual remembrance until their human identities were entirely forgotten and they became immortals who feast beneath the earth. Perhaps the Neolithic or Bronze Age cups found in barrows gave rise to the idea of the fairy feast and the accompanying warning to mortals never to join it by accepting food or drink. As the ancestral dead, the fairies received all those dead the church could not, the souls of the unbaptized and of suicides who were buried in unconsecrated ground and therefore in the unhallowed earth that still belonged to the ancestors. And so it was that people sometimes claimed to glimpse familiar faces among the fairy host as they made their way silently across the autumn landscape. We have kept the association between Halloween and the dead, as every plastic skeleton bears witness. But the stranger link between Halloween, the earth, and the deified ancestors who became the shining court of the fairies is harder to recover. Halloween's ancient association with the fairies reminds us of the unnumbered dead who have returned to the bosom of the earth and feast there yet, perhaps, with the mighty ancestors of old.
That was Francis Young. And finally, Rory Sutherland.
The legendary music producer Rick Rubin once asked me why I'd never moved to the United States. The answer, I think, comes down to an important trade-off: quantity of earnings versus quality of consumption. Whereas the United States is certainly a better place to earn and accumulate money, Europe is, on balance, still a better place to spend it, which may explain why Rick asked me that question at his summer home in Italy. This imbalance partly arises from a fundamental asymmetry in the transmission of ideas. Whenever anything good or interesting arises in the New World, freedom of religion, Breaking Bad, drive-through KFCs, nachos, Amazon, stem cell therapy or cup holders, these things rapidly make their way eastwards across the Atlantic. Yet the same process does not happen in reverse. If you want great Indian restaurants, medieval cathedrals, M&S food, free healthcare, border castles, sausage rolls, country pubs, 4 weeks holiday, tea made with boiling water and drinking outdoors, then you're basically stuck living here. Standard economics does not understand this distinction at all, since it assumes that quantity of money translates directly into quality of life. Until recently, freshman economics students were sometimes asked whether they'd prefer to earn $60,000 a year in a world where everybody else averages $40,000 a year, or to earn $80,000 a year in a world where everybody else averages $120,000. When a sizable majority picked the former, they were told that they were wrong to do so. This kind of nonsensical assertion suggests that modern economics should be considered as little more than a mathematicized religion rather than a serious attempt to model human reality. People are now increasingly discovering that beyond a certain threshold, you can improve your life far more easily by optimizing your consumption than by maximizing your earnings. The reason this is a recent discovery is that historically, once you had a job, there was a limit to the lifestyle changes you could make, not least because you couldn't move anywhere else. If you earned money in London, you lived in London, spent money in London and paid tax in the UK. If you're under 40, the worst part was probably not the tax, but the ruinous cost of accommodation. Government has always pandered to the super wealthy because it was accepted that such people could leave the country in pursuit of lower taxes and sunshine. The rest of us, it was assumed, couldn't move anywhere else. That's no longer true of the talented young, for whom the opportunity to work from anywhere may soon be the single most important factor in their career decisions. A banking salary in London is inarguably better than a publishing salary in London. But what happens when the choice is between £120,000 a year in London and £80,000 a year in Portugal? Not quite so easy now, is it? After all, whose social media do you really envy? The talented coder hanging out with tanned kite surfers, or the person in a suit in a Canary Wharf all bar one, drinking with a fixed income trading desk before heading home to Muswell Hill in the dark? There have always been cities which have cunningly exploited the super rich and their mobility. The Riviera, and now Dubai, are purpose-built for this. But what the Portuguese are doing is ingenious. They're trying to attract the talented and mobile young. Not only with visas, but with proposals dramatically to cut tax rates for people under 35. It's inevitable that a few other countries will follow this route. We need to consider the risk that Britain will soon face a new kind of migration crisis, this time in the opposite direction.
And that's everything for this week. For more articles, pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine or check out our website. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate or review. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.